Step into the wealth elevator and join our 12,000 plus member community who have passively invested over $200 million to acquire over $2.1 billion in commercial real estate. Sign up by going to thewealthelevator.com/club. And here we go.
Hey folks, just got off a call with an investor this week. What I'm seeing a lot from investors who maybe bought some rental properties in the last few years after doing a refinance in 2019 to 2022, great time to do that. And they bought rental properties and now running into issues with rental properties. So there's nothing turnkey about turnkey properties and looking to get more into the world of syndications and private placements. If that sounds like you, join our group at thewealthelevator.com/club and book an onboarding call with myself. And I try to open up a couple of call slots on the weekend because I know you guys are pretty busy on the weekdays. For those of you guys who I've already talked to, as you guys know, we've been pretty slow on the acquisition side since the summer of 2022. Why is this? You know, the loan to values that we used to get at 70% have gone down drastically at 50%, requiring me to bring a lot more down payment capital to the table, which totally throws the return on investment economics out of whack, which is why I haven't really been doing too much lately. And it's been forcing me over the past year to look beyond real estate. Obviously, real estate has gotten me to where I'm at today. Great leverage, the four ways you make money. I wrote this in a pretty in-depth article at thewealthelevator.com/returns. Check that out if a lot of this is new to you guys. But for more advanced investors out there, you start to gravitate towards non-hard asset investing after a certain point. So those of you guys who are on the newsletter, you guys are going to start to see some of these opportunities start to come out that are going to be a little bit more out there. For real estate to really work, you need to have good leverage, good interest rates. And what I'm seeing is we may not see this happen in the next year or two. Economic signals, the Atlanta Fed's GDP outlook is showing slower personal income growth, and which is good, I think, for us, as we want to see the soft landing of the economy, which is seemingly happening right before our eyes. The Atlanta GDP's outlook for quarter one 2024 predicts a 2.1% growth rate, which is right in line with a semi-healthy economy. The personal consumption expenditures PCE price inflation index, they're seeing that to be 2.8, which is the lowest since March of 2021, which says that what the Fed has been doing has been working to cool off inflation. The consensus is 2024 might be tough for industry out there, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel with potential recovery around 2025, which means now is the perfect time to get involved in projects, real estate and outside of real estate, because a lot of these projects are going to be 1 to 3 year value add opportunities. So unless you get it now, the bus is going to leave you behind. And some of these might be outside in the professional services industry. Maybe I've spilled the beans a little bit too much, but I'll release more information over the coming weeks on some of what's coming up for our group. You know, one big example outside of the world of real estate in terms of virtual online businesses is the latest Google shakeup. So Google unveiled their latest SEO update, and this is aimed at cutting down on low quality content, especially because there's a lot of AI writers out there and people who've been tinkering websites with gray hat tactics over the last decade. You know, you have a lot of companies that might have ranked on the first few pages of the Google search aren't there anymore. And this is a huge displacement. And ultimately, Google is trying to play referee and send the best information to the top of the pages. But it's just an opportunity for other operators to come in there and get this displacement in the realm of running online content websites. And that's just one little universe within a huge multiverse of you've got real estate here, and then you've got larger, you've got other asset classes up here where you can make a much higher return. Before we start to talk about different investment galaxies, which might be new to a lot of you guys as real traditional hard asset investors, on this week's podcast, Geography with Geoff, where we're going to be talking more about these long-term trends so that we don't get caught in the minutia of what changes day by day, month by month. I think at the end of the day, I'm still always going to be investing in real estate due to the long-term prospects of population growth and especially in the lower middle class workforce housing sector, which we develop in that type of arena. But with that, the new book is coming out this next month. We had some editorial snags. There were some things I wanted to add in there last minute that kind of delayed things. If you guys are interested in that, shoot us an email, team@thewealthelevator.com. We'll put you guys on the advanced list. We need some people to help us get the word out with some reviews. We'll send you a preview and we'll release some free chapters out to you guys. But enjoy the podcast. I tell you guys all the time not to watch these doom and gloom podcasts out there that are trying to get you to click on their little affiliate link to buy gold because the world is ending. I've always have been more into like industry-specific newsletters, economists that don't really have skin in the game to emotionally move you to one side of a buying transaction. And I still watch a lot of YouTube, right? I got YouTube Premium. Premium allow you to binge watch YouTube without all the ads. So if you got a little money to burn, which I know a lot of you guys do as credit investors, I would highly recommend it. But YouTube brought me and Jeff together. Jeff runs a YouTube channel where he's got 141,000 subscribers. In case you guys are wondering, I would probably say anybody over a couple thousand subscribers is semi-legitimate. Jeff is definitely 100x that. But I was watching this video about 5 events that will change America by 2050. And that's where we're going to go a little bit more into discussion in detail today. These are the type of people I like to try and follow, right? People who don't have really skin in the game to influence one way or another. They're more into the data and they're unbiased, I think, is what I'm getting at. But yeah, thanks for answering the call. Like I said, Jeff, I shot you a random email out in the blue and I thought it'd make a good conversation because I think what we do here is a little bit different than just having another multifamily operator who has under $1 billion of assets just trying to get their name across some way, somehow. Jeff, give us a little background on yourself, right? Like, you're passionate about this, obviously.
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I'm here because of my YouTube channel, but in a past life, I actually like to say that I'm a recovering city planner. I have my master's degree in city planning, as well as my bachelor's degree in geography, which sort of gives me the credentials for my YouTube channel as well. But for a long time, I helped, more specifically here in Portland and the Oregon region at large, figure out how to better plan for the future and how to make the best use of our land and our transportation systems and all that fun stuff that we pay a lot of people to think about so that we don't find ourselves in a situation 10, 20 years down the road where the city's just not working as well as it should be. I mean, of course, that doesn't always work out as well when you're planning. Obviously, things go left or right. In the end, I really like geography. I'm like you said, Lane, I'm a big data person. I love looking at data. And over the past year and a half, I was starting to notice trends. I was noticing trends in policies that were being passed, in environmental trends that were happening. And through that, I was able to extrapolate out a few different trends that were at least highly likely, maybe likely going to happen by 2050. Nothing is wildly out there, right? It's all pretty grounded in data. For example, the amount of people that might be here in 2050 in the US, that's all grounded in US census data. But of course, it's also in the future and nobody can fully predict the future.
I actually was in the same department in the city of Kirkland up in Washington.
Interesting.
So I worked alongside some city planners, but we weren't we were suburban type of neighborhood. I imagine the city of Portland, just like the city of Seattle, is very bureaucratic. There's got to be like
very
20 planners, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, more than that. Yeah. Because it also gets broken out by the transportation division, the parks division, the housing division. It's each one of those has a whole gaggle of planners.
Yeah. So you're still working your day job then?
No, I exclusively do my podcast and my YouTube full time. And then
good
I also teach
you
at Portland State. So I'm in the Portland State Geography Department as well. So
what made you quit the government job?
My last job was actually with a nonprofit doing electric transportation stuff. So looking ahead at what electric transportation was going to be in the future and how we can get there. So that'd be like electric cars, but also electric bikes and electric school buses, XYZ. To what you just said, Lane, it got to a point where I didn't really need the income from my day job. And I had to make a decision about whether I was going to go all in on being my own sort of boss and going for this YouTube thing and as well as the podcast thing and devoting my time to that and growing that. And therefore, I would have to eschew the traditional job structure because I just flat out didn't have enough time in the week anymore to do both.
Yeah.
I was running on fumes after a year and 3 months of doing both nearly full time each.
Yeah. Yeah, I knock working for the government, but I actually found a lot of cool people like yourself. When I was, you know, I had to go into the city planner's office to do my projects, and I would interact with a lot of high quality people who were very smart, but they just didn't need to get paid that top dollar in private industry. And whether it was maybe they had a spouse that was a doctor and just rock on this easier job, or they were independently wealthy, or maybe they invest in real estate like how we do, right? But it was always funny, like they were some high quality people and really get to know people. A lot of them have other income sources of passive income or a highly compensated spouse working for them. But yeah, let's dive into these five events that will change America by 2050.
Yeah, let's do it.
So I guess maybe preface this, like, where does the information come from? What are some of your sources?
There's five different sort of predictions, and each one of them has their own source. So if we start with the top one, which is the amount of people that there'll be, I think I'm saying by 2050, there'll be anywhere between 400 and 440 million Americans. To give your audience a little bit of a preview of what we're at today, we're about 332 million. So that'd be growing by at least 70 million Americans over the next 2.5 decades. And this isn't just for the U.S. Census. Each state does this as well. But the U.S. Census does predict out what the population is going to be based on the trends that they're seeing. And so the U.S. Census, they have a big old report that basically says, here's what it's going to look like in 2030 and 2040. I think 2050 is the latest they've now projected out. And then they further go in and break it down by state. And so that's how I was able to find where things were happening and what the U.S. Census was going to, where the U.S. Census was predicting people were going to move to. In which case, the U.S. Census was saying that, hey, in 2050, California is still going to be the largest state. It's the largest state today with about 40 million people. But in 2050, it's probably going to be closer to around 49 million. And then that sort of follows down with the states that you would expect, right? Texas and Florida also growing considerably during this time. And then Georgia and I think New York being number five. But this is where I take some of my own research around climate change and start to think about, okay, so if there's going to be this amount of people moving to these southern states, but we also know that climate change is going to drastically impact a lot of the regions that we're talking about in terms of water availability, in terms of sea level rise, all things that California is struggling with now, what could that possibly mean for if these people do come and where would they go? In which case, okay, we know that studies have been done through journals like the Nature Journal, through studies through MIT and Harvard, that there are estimates of where people will move to under these severe climate scenarios, in which case places such as the Pacific Northwest, so that would just be west of the Cascade Mountains, so that'd be your Willamette Valley and Seattle, places that are relatively wet and are predicted to get even though they're predicted to get warmer, they're predicted to get more precipitation, they would probably absorb more people. And then, of course, the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes hold fully 21% of all surface water in the world. That's an incredible amount of fresh surface water. And in a rapidly drying world, you have to think of where are people going to want to live, where there's going to be an abundance of one of life's most desired, most needed resources, and that is fresh water. So there's a lot of studies that sort of predict the Great Lakes states, despite losing population today, having a rebound under some of these climate change scenarios.
And I'll maybe rebut with a couple ideas. First off, like, I'm a big believer of like technology, and in Seattle, well, build a damn seawall, or certainly in Texas, don't build it in those 50-year floodplain level, or even the 25 for that matter. But I think at the end of the day, as an investor, I'm not in it till 2050. The goal for our investors, get your $4-5 million net worth and get back into traditional investments. Maybe I shouldn't say that on the podcast, because that's more for the higher net worth investors, right? The lower net worth investors need to be in alternatives, gambling on one side of this equation or not. But if you play your cards, what is this 2025 to make that easy? You should be able to get yours by 2030 or 2035, well before some of these, I think, valid points you're making before it hits there. But I don't know, like, what's your thought process on Marvel Man being able to pump water to Las Vegas? That's a marvel in itself.
Yours. Yeah, and that's what we've been doing since 1933 when we built a series of reservoirs to Los Angeles and Phoenix from the Colorado River. Unfortunately, the Colorado River has been showing its age a little bit, and it's been drying out. And there are questions around how sustainable is Phoenix long term. There's a very wealthy community outside of Phoenix that used to get its water from Scottsdale. And Scottsdale, they're not part of Scottsdale. They exist outside in unincorporated Maricopa County. And Scottsdale basically said, we're no longer going to give you any water. We need it for ourselves. And so now this community, which again, it's pretty wealthy, they're stuck in a situation that is very challenging, to say the least. So I think I'm not an investor. I'm not telling anybody to do anything with their money. I'm just talking about the geography of the climate situation as is and what we're seeing, right? So even looking out to 2030 or 2035, there are issues that are happening today that are impacting the livability of some of these places. If we go to Florida or South Carolina or Alabama, Mississippi, they're already having issues with coastal degradation, right? There are houses that are falling into the ocean today. Again, these are things that are happening now. They're projected to get worse. The rate at which they get worse is up to debate. Whether there's a world-saving technology that comes out in the next 10 years, that's also up for debate. I don't have that information. There could be something that ultimately is able to help us correct the course a little bit and reverse some of these trends. But as of now, this is what scientists are predicting. And so it really does make the equation of where are people going to want to live pretty challenging, right? So again, if we're going to be at 400 million Americans or 440 million Americans in 2050, going back to my original prediction, how many of those people are going to want to move to an area that they have to deal with constant flooding from the oceans and the tides? And I think that's where you start getting some questions. And of course, you can always build a seawall around certain areas, right? The San Francisco Bay Area, the whole Central Valley is pretty well underwater. That would, under certain scenarios, that is expected to flood. However, you can fairly easily create a seawall, right? It'd be expensive. You can fairly easily create a seawall to mitigate that.
Yeah, just put Florida, $100 bill stacks. And but let's be honest, ain't nobody building a seawall in Louisiana and Mississippi and Gulf Shores, Alabama. That ain't gonna happen.
Or it's too much space. That it's such a long, you're talking about thousands of miles of seawall that would be needed. And that's where the infrastructure sort of falls short, right? You have an entire country such as the Netherlands, which has reclaimed vast amounts of land since over the last century or two through their seawall. Marvel of technology. They've done a really awesome job at managing the ocean, which is impressive when you start thinking about it. But they're also a small country, right? They have a very finite amount of space. You're talking about basically the entire Gulf of Mexico, all the way up to the eastern shore, up to New York. That's a lot of space that would need a seawall under certain scenarios.
Yeah. I think the way I play it, again, I'm not in it for 30 years, but like you take a big top five metropolitan city like Houston, if the southern east quadrant floods or becomes unlivable in the next half a century, which I don't see it happening to that extent, the places like the Woodlands, the north side, Katy on the west side become much more of that. Those were where you should probably put more investment into. Leads into my next question. I watch a lot of YouTube videos and they talk about mega cities. Where are you in this divide? Are people going to clump into more the bigger cities and they become mega cities? Or is the rise of what we call tertiary markets, right? These markets such as, I'm just going to pull up the map here. Oh, Eco Texas or a Killeen, Texas, like something on the I-35 corridor that's under 250,000 population. Are those going to be growing or is it maybe a little bit both? I don't know. What's your educated guess?
Yeah. So if we look at history, we can see a pretty clear migration pattern for people. And that is people generally move to the larger cities within any given region due to the economic means. Almost always when somebody is moving from one part of the country to the next, or even across the world, they're doing so for some sort of economic reason. And historically, going back to when urbanization started happening, we were largely agrarian up until about the mid-1800s, and then industrial revolution started happening, economy and wealth started accumulating within cities, and therefore people would start accumulating and moving to cities to be a part of that wealth generation. So that's been the historic trend.
People need a hookup if they want kids and want to make a family. So
exactly
where the jobs are. But isn't that some people I think are a little bit too on the side of office space is going to go away. People aren't working from home. I think they're a little bit too much on that side, which takes away from the mega city theory a little bit.
I have no idea how that whole thing is going to shake out. The work from home versus in office versus some sort of hybrid model in the future. I think there's definitely a change that's happened, right? COVID pandemic initiated this change, probably sped it along. We were probably going there anyways, just with technologies such as Zoom that we're both sitting on right now. I think there will inevitably be people who will gravitate to the larger cities for the same reason as anybody, certainly when they're starting out in their professional career. cities are dynamic. There's things happening in them. That's where the concerts are. That's where the sports are. People end up liking these things. And therefore, regardless of the other aspects, the economic means, people still generally like to be within a major metropolitan area, not least because there's also the ability to transport yourself pretty easily, right? If you're in Portland, you can take a nonstop flight to Amsterdam any day of the week. If you're in even a smaller city of, say, Eugene, Oregon, which is just a couple hours south of Portland, Eugene is growing. You can maybe take a flight to Portland and then from Portland to somewhere else or to Seattle, but you're not going to have any international destinations. So I think a lot of people think about these kinds of things as they, certainly when they get out of college, for example, where do they want to establish themselves? Now, of course, when somebody gets a little bit later in life and they have a little bit more economic freedom, they can be a little bit choosier. And so in which case, maybe then they say, I'm going to move to Spokane, or I'm going to move to, yeah, I don't know, Meridian, Idaho, that kind of stuff.
The way I personally play it, where I put my dollars is they're still going to stay in the major city, your top 20, 30 cities, but in more of the suburb part. So outside the loops of the highway. So I guess Portland. I used to actually live in Vancouver, right? That's actually a good example, right? I lived in the Alphabet District 1 year when I was younger too. But that's the kind of places that we'll invest in, is like outside of that, like 30 minutes outside, maybe even an hour. Traffic is really bad. But yeah, I'm betting on that, you know, the mega city thing to trend. But maybe let me ask you this as ex-city planner, right? Like you have these, I don't know what they call them, like the mixed use buildings where you have the coffee shop and commercial on the floor. Then you have two or three story of multifamily. And these are typically in the outskirts of downtown areas. Like, for example, I know Portland, like in the northeast area, you have a lot of this type of stuff, right? Where they cluster around the salt and straw ice cream and the food truck places.
Like, exactly. Yeah.
Is that kind of cyclical? People move to a place like the Alphabet District, downtown core business district, and then they go to, I don't know, I'm missing the word for this, but like these kind of outside cities within the city?
Yeah, we call them more like inner ring city or inner city. So it's not quite downtown. The internal migration pattern, I don't know how well that holds up, that people would necessarily move downtown and then spread out. Certainly not in the last few years, as a lot of downtowns have become ghost towns. But I think generally cities like Portland, and I think, you know, Seattle as well, I can't talk about too many other cities because I'm just not as familiar with them, have done a really good job at establishing these sort of neighborhood corridors, right? Spread around Portland, there's this bunch of streets, just to name a few. There's like Mississippi Street, there's Hawthorne, there's Division Street, and all is a lot of apartment buildings, this mixed use, a dynamic atmosphere, mid-rise buildings, coffee shops, bars, restaurants, shops, what have you. But then directly off that street is your normal housing, maybe some duplexes and triplexes, single family houses, maybe an apartment building scattered here and there. And what this has done is it's created a corridor where people can live and do all of their shopping and dining and playing without really needing to go all the way across the city to a designated entertainment district, which is perhaps something that's more common in other cities, but certainly not here. And I think that model does work very well. That way, people don't feel the need to travel for 30 minutes just getting to what they want, in which case, a lot of times they might not do it at all. And so it keeps money flowing. People want to eat out more, all that kind of fun stuff. So I do think those areas, Portland and Seattle, I think those areas are ripe for growth, especially now that we're starting to see here in Oregon, but also in Washington and California and now Maine, a relaxing of single family zoning where now duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, these kinds of things are allowed to be built on single family zone areas. I think there's a lot of growth potential where these places are going to become built up a little bit more. And so we're going to start seeing a lot more types of houses over the next 30, 40 years. And then I think just naturally, there's going to be a lot more people living in each of these cities.
We've been talking about this on some of the weekly reports. I call this kind of the battleground development bills, most notably in like California, but I don't know if this happened in Portland too. But basically, you have a lot of these single family homes, not in my neighborhood type of people. Mm-hmm. And it just costs too damn much for people to live near around the city. City ordinances are slowly being changed to allow for duplexes, triplexes, or quads, and maybe even bigger stuff, as Jeff is mentioning. It's in a way kind of allowing a little bit of bursting at the seams, a little bit more that'll play out very slowly in the next decades to come. Something interesting to watch is obviously the progressive blue states like Portland or Oregon, Washington, and California will lead the charge on it. Something to watch, because typically we as investors live in those places, but And most of us, we invest in these red states that don't have this huge demand on their space. There's some room.
You're right. It is right now, it's West Coast, very liberal. Also Maine, traditionally pretty liberal, New England. But we are starting to see, I don't think this policy of relaxing development rules really falls along traditional political battlegrounds. I think you hear a little bit of stuff coming out of Florida and the politics there. However, if we look over at Montana, they're pretty close to doing something very similar, which is relaxing the single family zoning rule to allow for more types of development so that places like Missoula is probably the biggest one, are still able to grow and still able to be affordable for people who live there and grown and were raised there rather than people who are trying to move there because they're trying to escape a more expensive city elsewhere.
But like a place like Missoula and Maui, for example, it's all, everything's the feet right up in the air. Now that you can build up 30, that's nothing huge like in the big cities, which totally. I think is good. Mm-hmm. That's good, especially if you
live. Yeah, and none of it's drastic, right? None of it's, I think the biggest worry is certainly when I was a city planner that people would talk to me about is that they thought a law would pass, or this policy would pass, and all of a sudden, it's like a key turning on an engine, and all of a sudden, a bunch of houses are going to come down in their place. It's going to be a big apartment building. Now, we're talking like this is decades. It's a slow, cities change slowly, right? It's going to be decades where things are just going to start filling in a little bit here and there, so much so that most people would never even notice. In fact, I would say most of the people here inside where I live in Portland, which is the inner sort of area of Portland, probably don't realize how many duplexes already do exist. And there's actually quite a few of them. They're just all built from an age before single family zoning mandated that only single family houses could be built.
Allowing people to increase the density ever so slightly, as you mentioned, is going to be far outpaced by, like you said, population growth in migration.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think so too.
So let's talk a little bit about high-speed rail, right, is a big growth. Now, in the red states that we're in, like Phoenix, Houston, Dallas, Alabama, Florida, well, I guess Florida has their high-speed rail, but this is another dynamic that impacts where people, a lot of our investors will live. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say, so two of the most prominent high-speed rail projects are coming from, honestly, two of the most conservative states, Texas and Florida. And Florida even has theirs operational. So it's called the Bright Line. It currently only runs from Miami to Orlando. It'll travel somewhere around 145, 150 miles per hour. So pretty fast. It'll get you there in a couple of hours, I think. And
the way I was taking a look at that too, and I was like, and like, for what it's worth, like politically, some people have qualms with the way Florida does things, right? But man, do they get stuff like that done quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, it's a very interesting case scenario, right? So it's a private company, which is the opposite model of California. And we can talk a little about California as well, because that's a whole other thing. But it's a private company called Brightline. They established this market and were able to work with the Florida government and get all the sort of sign off. And they privately funded it and were able to sell bonds. It really is a good model for how high-speed rail can be accomplished within corridors of the United States. And right now, it's really the only good example. I mean, there's the Acela, which is an Amtrak that runs in the Northeast Corridor. But that's, again, that's a whole other thing. They are going to be very successful, I think. They also are the ones that have the contract to eventually build the Las Vegas to Los Angeles high-speed rail line. If it was any other company, I'd be a little bit more dubious on how that project was going to come along, especially because I've been hearing about that for 20 years now. And so I think now, with that company, they actually mean business.
Maybe explain a little bit for people who don't know, like the differences between the way the California will structure that contract with internally versus a private group like that. Our guys like to know, we'll never invest in California or places like that unless it was some kind of sexy project in and out. But like we live there, right?
Yeah.
Like Florida, man, you got to watch out for Florida, man, right? That's the whole game. You type in Florida, man, and you put in your birthday to see all the crazy stuff that happens out there. Or there's no zoning in Houston. So that's why growth can happen. Maybe not the best place to raise a family, or you don't want to be there because your political affiliations don't last. But hey, if my money's going to grow faster, live where you want. That's where the numbers make sense, is what I say.
Yeah. I can give a high level of sort of the compare and contrast with California. And California, very, I think, probably most people who live in California know that in 2008, they passed a measure that said that California was going to devote a number of billions of dollars to develop this high-speed rail line. But I think what ended up happening there, a test case for other high-speed rails, was that they opted not to rely on expertise from outside of the country. So we, as Americans, we like to say Americans are exceptional in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of very exceptional people in this country. But high-speed rail is not something we've ever really had expertise in. And so that ended up creating a lot of issues that have stymied the project from the get-go, especially given the already California very bureaucratic state, very heavily regulated in a lot of ways, and very political too, right? So the route had to change a number of times. So to contrast that with the Brightline, which does have that expertise, is a private company, is able to hire that expertise and not rely on that, they were able to just move a lot faster, a lot quicker, and frankly, a lot more efficiently. They also, because they weren't necessarily politically bound, right? They're a private entity. They could piecemeal it, right? So California came out the gate and said, we're going to do LA to San Francisco. And it's going to open by, I think originally it was supposed to open by 2022 or something, or maybe even 2018. I don't remember. When in reality, a private company could have gone in and said, hey, we're going to do LA to Bakersfield. And then they're going to grow from there. And then doing LA to Bakersfield, that's much easier, right? That's a smaller chunk. You can do that a lot easier. Whereas, and that's what the Brightline train is doing, right? It did Miami to Miami Beach, and then it's going to add on to Orlando. And from there, it'll probably add on to somewhere else, maybe Tampa. That's a major advantage. It also allows you to not raise the land prices of where your route's going to be. Another issue that California's had to deal with. They established where their route was going to be, and all of a sudden land got a lot more expensive because you know that the government's going to need this land. And so therefore, you're going to charge a little bit of a premium on that land. And so those are the two biggest contrasts between those two that I would say. I would expect future high-speed rail projects like the one that is being explored for the Pacific Northwest, so Portland to Vancouver, BC, by way of Seattle, to be run in a similar manner to Brightline, if not contracted out to Brightline specifically.
So this other one, trees.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with everybody. Probably in one day, I'll be very much attuned to this, maybe in a decade. But yeah, talk to us about this tree shift in America. How does that impact how things will change?
Yeah, so I guess just some historical background. We, just over the last 300 years that we've been a country, and even since before that, when we were still colonies, we've hollowed out a lot of our forests, right? We use wood in a lot of our buildings, even to this day. And so that has caused general effects on the climate, especially microclimates or interregional. But now we're starting to see that trees are the biggest and most helpful sort of carbon sucking machines. And so that is having climate change effects as well. And so to combat this, the United States, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, by way of the Forest Service, has promising to plant 1 billion new trees. So this is in addition to what they already do inside their current replanting efforts to establish and resolidify a lot of the forests that have been cut down. And this would be places like in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, huge lumber industry. Replanting there, replanting in historic forests in the Southeast, as well as in the Northeast and the Great Lakes area. In terms of what this means broadly for the U.S., I think the biggest implications are, one, if we are able to establish 1 billion new trees by 2030, that's a forest that's the size of the state of Connecticut, roughly. If we're able to keep up that trend, we could probably do 4 billion new trees by 2050. And so that then becomes a new forest the size of New Hampshire and Vermont combined, which doesn't seem like a lot, but we're talking about a whole new forest that's actually a lot of carbon sucking that can happen. And so that just has impacts down the road for where we're going on in terms of our climate change journey, right? It's going to play an impact on where we ultimately land in terms of how much warmer we get. Are we going to minimize it or are we going to keep growing it? Are we going to provide more land for wildlife? The U.S. is making this a choice to regrow these forests and keep them as forests long term. And so there's not really any sort of direct impacts on cities, right? None of these will be built in cities. They'll be built in current natural wildlife areas. I'm thinking the Mount Hood National Forest, for example, will probably get a considerable amount of replanting. If you are a hunting fan or a fishing fan, this should be awesome news for you because forests mean more wildlife and forests actually mean much healthier rivers, as it turns out. But in terms of where people are going to live, it probably won't have that much of an impact. It's more of a, hey, this is something that's really good that's coming our way. And I think people should feel positive and feel good about all the trees that are coming because trees are great. Everybody loves trees.
Some of our investors, especially the ones that make over $350,000 a year, will do those land conservation easement deal. Mm-hmm. Of course, you got to find the right people to do it through. But that sounds like it is aligned with that long-term trend.
It could be, yeah. Yeah. Again, I think, you know, anybody who's interested, USDA, the Forest Service has plans, a lot of plans that are coming out of about where they're going to be targeting their efforts around tree planting. I'm not sure on the specifics of that. I didn't really dive into exactly where they were going to plant trees inside my video. They would have to do a little bit of research, but there could be some interest there for sure.
My investment thesis personally today is I don't really like, but I acknowledge the trend that the wealthy are getting wealthier, the lower are getting lower, and the middle class is being sucked to the middle class. Therefore, there's this growing demand for workforce housing in the lower middle class. How do you see that changing in cities, or I guess maybe speak a little bit? We talked about previously in this general population. Can dial in maybe a little bit, maybe on age ranges or like demographics of salary or income ranges. How does that, any thoughts or?
Yeah, I would say, to your point, I think, you know, you're definitely correct in that the wealthy are getting wealthier. We know that. We know the poor are getting poorer. And we know that the middle class aren't really growing that much at all. It's been very minimal. And now, even with the inflation as it's been happening, probably shrinking a little bit in terms of overall wealth. I think for certainly new professionals who are just getting into the game, it's a very pessimistic market. It's very, how am I ever going to afford, even if I'm working at a new engineer at Google, making $150,000 a year, you're not affording a house on $150,000 a year in Mountain View or the Bay Area. So I think a lot of new graduates are thinking about this. Okay, what does it mean to own a home? And so I think a lot of city planners like myself have been noodling on this issue for quite a long time, in which case we know that there is a gap in housing. We call it the missing middle, in that we have built a lot of apartments, right? These are places somebody can jump in for a year, 2 years, maybe even 10 years. They can live there and pay rent and XYZ, or they can buy a single family house that's fairly expensive, $500,000, $750,000, $1 million+. There's some middle ground there, right? There's these condos that sort of float around. They're not as common as maybe they should be. But then there's a whole spectrum of housing that is basically completely missing. This would be townhouse. You know, you see them in some cities such as Philadelphia, but townhouses, row houses, garden condominiums, right? So it's like a bunch of apartments, six apartments that are scattered around like a little garden in the middle. And these are the things that would normally be that housing type, that housing variety where, you know, hey, I'm a new professional. I just got my first job and now I want to buy a house and increase my wealth. Because we know here in the United States that one of the best ways to increase your wealth over the long term is to own your own home. And so therefore, they would want to buy something, but they can't. And so they get locked out of the market for an extended period of time, if not forever. And so I think certainly a lot of cities, if we go back to these policies towards relaxing the zoning, that's sort of the intent. It's to, how do we infill our land with this quote unquote missing middle type of housing so that people actually can afford to buy it. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and where we're going. I think there's definitely going to be probably more condos and smaller condos that are popped up, right? So quadplex that maybe each unit is sold individually. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot more of those coming in the future in California, Oregon, and Washington, but other kinds as well. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out and how it changes the market. I think regardless, we can say that the suburban sort of big, large lot, single family houses that have been developers' bread and butter over the last 40, 50 years is not sustainable for people who want to get into the market anymore.
Building for that younger professional under 30, maybe even 35. So a lot of our investors will start in this world. They'll buy what's called like a turnkey rental where somebody will fix up the property, put it in there for you. Most of our credit investors don't do that stuff because it's too much pain and anguish. When I was doing that stuff way back in 2012, there were a couple options. First, you would buy an older house, like a 1960s, 1970s house in a more mature neighborhood. So you infill, right? And then some of these turnkey providers will build like tracks out, expanding outside the expanded zone, right? The developing area. Really, there's nothing out there yet. You got any opinions there? Like one better than the other, like the infill versus, I always think about it like in terms of the water line. When the market is good, the water line goes up and it like literally your development and growth will go up radiating from the city center. But then when a recession happens, it'll contract and then it'll go back up, track and go back up. Is, I don't know, do you think people would rather, maybe I'm just asking you to put your city planner on hat on, would people rather have something older, nearer to the more mature core area or newer side there, I guess?
So it's a timeless debate, I think. I think there's a lot of people who really like living on the outskirts in the suburban areas, and that's fine, right? That market exists. I think we're increasingly seeing a more unpredictable pattern of these, as these suburban developments get farther and farther out of the town, they become more susceptible to the natural disasters that might strike. So if we take that community outside of Scottsdale, Arizona that now doesn't have water anymore. That's something that these people probably didn't really think was going to be an issue when they bought 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Or if we look at some of the tragic areas of communities being demolished by wildfires in California and other states, right? These are areas that are just naturally going to be more susceptible to those kinds of risks. If I put my city planner hat on, barring the very major natural disasters such as an earthquake, right? Portland, Seattle, like they're not really in any danger of these kinds of natural disasters that blow through. The suburbs probably are, and as they encroach more and get farther and farther out, they are. They're definitely more in danger of those kinds of things.
So they're still going to stay in the major city, but in more of the suburb.
So again, I'm not an investor. I'm not telling anybody to put their money anywhere, but I definitely, from a city planning perspective, I think the city's infill is a little bit of a safer area for people generally.
Any idea or anything in the next video, I guess, that you're passionate about?
I don't know when this podcast can be published. My next video is going to be on I'm calling it the Empty North. So it's basically looking at that region around Montana and the Dakotas, as well as Eastern Washington and Idaho and all these places, and why there are so few people that live. I don't know if I necessarily have anything to share with respects to, again, people who might want to invest in the area. Aside from that, there are very real reasons why people live where they do, right? I think broadly, if we look at today's trends, broadly, Americans like to move to where it's warm. Even places that might, in my opinion, be too warm, such as Phoenix, people tend to really like, right? They really enjoy that. So people move there. So weather is a big reason why people want to move south, away from places such as the Great Lakes, which can typically have harsh, colder winters. I think what's left up in the air is how things change over the next few decades. We've seen, will these other cities ever fully go away? No, probably not. There would have to be something very dramatic that would have to happen for that to happen. But we could see a hollowing out similar that we saw Detroit happen in between 1970 and 2000, right? That sort of, they underwent a few decades of shrinking.
I mean, Detroit sucked because they lost their economy.
Yeah. And it only can be a sort of a domino effect, right? And once that happens, the economy takes a hit. And when the economy takes a hit, people move, right? People will always move when they can't find work and they can't find a way to make a living for themselves. So they will move to where they can. So it doesn't take much, to be honest. So we saw that in Detroit, the economy took a hit, manufacturing plants closed, and people moved away from those areas.
That's always a chicken and egg thing. Is it jobs that leads it, or is it general population growth?
It's a chicken and eggs situation, especially when a city is starting. How are you going to get people to move out to a city without jobs? And how are you going to get jobs to move to a city without people there? So it's one of those things. And so it can be in the reverse as well.
I think back, generally, population in America is going up, where some of these other countries, it's going down, right? Like China. Mm-hmm. That's the flow and demand is there. The question is, where is it going to the most and where is it backtracking from? But I think generally all top 50 metropolitan areas are increasing, are going to absorb all that kind of relatively easy. It's not.
Yeah, I think so. An additional 70 to 100 million Americans seems like a lot. And it is. That's pretty incredible growth if that actually pans out. A lot of that is due to immigration because our birth rate isn't much better than a lot of Western European or Japan or Korea or China birth rates, right? So if we just relied on our natural birth rates, the country would be shrinking as well. So a lot of this is due to, one, Americans living longer and migration coming from places such as Central America, such as Asia, Southeast Asia, such as Africa. And so that's going to spurn a lot of our growth in our cities. And generally, I think all the metro areas will be a net beneficiary of this because that's a lot of new people. And they will move to wherever they have a community to move to. In which case, a lot of Ukrainians ended up moving to the Portland region because there's a Ukrainian community here. It's just how it goes. So that'll probably be the first sort of thing to look out for.
Is there ever a point where the source of immigrants goes away? You guys ever talk about like a certain date out there? 2100 or
Immigration, right? It's obviously a very hot topic in the U.S. And so it's subject to the whims of whoever's controlling the government at any given time. That sort of immigration sort of faucet can be turned way down, as we saw under the Trump administration. It was turned down way down at certain points. And of course, under other administrations, it turns on a little bit more. There's always a scenario where immigration just doesn't happen due to a wide variety of things, whether it's political instability, right? People don't move to where there's political instability, because if there's political instability, that means there's economic instability. And if there's economic instability, that means people can't make money, and if people can't make money, then why are they going to move across the country to a place that they can't make money? And if there's that happening here, then yeah, of course, people wouldn't move here either naturally because they don't feel like it's a comfortable place to move to, or because the U.S. has shut its borders. It could happen. We'll see.
I like our chances. The lower middle class still live in 1,100 square feet apartments for little over $1.25 square feet. Where, yeah, in Asia, you're like living in sub 400 square feet quarters. And like you said, where you have trees here, air is a little bit cleaner. I like America. That's why I live here.
Yeah. We have trees, we have space, and we have, and some areas are struggling, but we have a lot of water here. And that those are three very important things to make the U.S. a very enviable country. And not a lot of countries have a lot of the natural bounty that the United States does.
Sometimes Portland and Seattle turns into a war zone for some strange reason, but for the most part, it's not a bad place to live.
No, I wouldn't live anywhere else in the country, to be honest.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks for coming on, Jeff. If you guys want to check out his YouTube channel, Geography by Jeff, we'll link it up in the show notes. But yeah, if you guys have any other good resources that you guys like, let us know, and we'll see you guys next time.
The proceeding is not tax, legal, or investment advice, nor an offer to sell securities or investment products. Always make informed decisions with professional guidance. Get educated and surround yourself with a community at thewealthelevator.com/club.